All right, thank you so much, and thank you for the kind invitation. So I'm going to tell you about recurrent neural networks for many body physics. So this is about machine learning and physics. So there's a lot of interest in particle physics, high energy physics, condensed matter, quantum information, basically all areas of physics. And there's a lot of interest and our exploration of ideas related to machine learning and its implications in these fields of research. If you are interested, you can read that interesting paper. It's a review of modern physics. Contains a lot of information, interesting discussions about this intersection between fields. And in particular, in quantum science research, there's machine learning exploration in, for instance, in strongly correlated fermions in chemistry, density functional theory, quantum Monte Carlo. There's things such as machine learning phases of matter in simulations or in experimental data, discovery of physical phenomena and laws, extracting those out of data. There's representations of quantum states in terms of neural networks, applications in normalization group and in quantum information, quantum control, and more. And this style of research is shaped in part by the commonalities among the problems that machine learning and physics disciplines address. So one of the most important commonalities is the high dimensionality. Okay, so the dimensionality, for instance, in quantum physics, it's very large. It's such that the generic specification of a quantum state requires resources that are exponential in the number of degrees of freedom. And for instance, so for a system of spin one half particles, the generic specification of the wave function is through a vector with 2 to the n components. And this growth is so large that even with today's best supercomputers, we can solve Schrödinger equation or the wave equation exactly for a maximum of about 45 spins if you exploit symmetries and all sort of conservation laws. And that's what we can do. And even though this is a large number, that's not enough because we're interested in many body systems with a large number of degrees of freedom. But what's important for, or interesting to me at least, is that, like for instance, machine learning models, like in particular language models, live in very high dimensional spaces too. And these models are used in machine learning all the time with a high success rate. So for instance, the exponential count that, for instance, they do it in this paper, attention is all you need, where they introduce this architecture called transformer. They have the following count. So they replace the local Hilbert space by the vocabulary size of the text you're trying to analyze. So for instance, you can imagine 8,000 words if you're reading a regular article in a journal. And then the maximum length of the sentence would replace the number of degrees of freedom. And so that gives you a big number as well. Okay, and yet, these models, even though they live in such high dimensional spaces, they're very successful. Okay, and the idea is that both in physics and in machine learning, many of the quantum states that we're interested in live in a lower dimensional subspace of the entire Hilbert space. Okay, and the same is true for the probability distributions that describe our language. Okay, and so that there's distributions that are realized in language and the way we speak and the way we write, they form only a subspace of this entire family of probability distributions that you could imagine writing. Okay, and so what we do in condensed matter physics and in machine learning is we exploit the structures, right, like to make progress. So because the amount of information in the states or in this machine learning task is usually smaller than this maximum capacity. And so that's what we do. We exploit these structures. For instance, when we do quantum Monte Carlo simulations, we perform a stochastic exploration of the most important regions of this gigantic space. Okay, and so here's the example. When we use tensor networks, we exploit the fact that some important quantum states realized in nature have little entanglement. So instead of having this very generic wave function, we split it in terms of, for instance, matrix product states. And what I wanted to highlight is both techniques have led to profound implications to our understanding of quantum many body systems and condensed matter and many other areas. And similarly, in machine learning, techniques exploit the structure present in natural data sets, in images, in natural language, and so on. And the commonalities between physical systems include, and machine learning systems include correlation functions, symmetries, for instance, translations, rotations, reflections, and more. And so since there's this common structure in machine learning and the physics problems that we care about, the question we've been asking for the past few years is, can we exploit the fact that this structure is shared, and can we make progress, right? But then, of course, you can argue all you want, but the question is, are these commonalities relevant or important for computational physics beyond the resemblance that we already know, okay? And so we've been exploring this question for the past few years. So I'm going to discuss some examples of this, and I'm going to use central ingredient behind this examples that I'm going to talk about is representation of the classical and a quantum state of a many-body system using recurrent neural networks. And we've done a bunch of work on this, and here I highlight a few. For instance, we have one here that I'm going to discuss. There's this paper about solving classical statistical mechanics from Lei Wang and Pan Zhang and Yang Wu. We have wave functions defined in terms of recurrent neural networks, and we have this technique called variational annealing that we've introduced that I'm going to discuss soon, and more. Okay, so that's the idea of using recurrent neural networks to understand many-body systems through exploiting these commonalities that we encounter in machine learning and physics. So I'm going to start describing what these models look like. So we're using this probabilistic autoregressive models, and this term autoregressive originates from the time series models, where observations from previous time steps are used to predict the current time step or the future steps. And consider a probability distribution P of sigma, where sigma are composed of, say, n degrees of freedom. They can be, for instance, classical spins or any variables you can imagine. So any probability distributions on n variables can be written down in terms of this product of conditional. This is called chain rule. Okay, so this is equal to probability of sigma 1 times probability of sigma 2 conditioned on sigma 1 times probability of sigma 3 conditioned on sigma 1 and sigma 2, and so on and so forth. So to specify P, that's this probability distributions in a tabular form, requires exponential resources, and so we, by writing this probability distribution in either this joint distribution or in this product of conditional distributions, you always require exponential resources. But what we can do is to alleviate this exponential issue, and we can parameterize this conditional through some nonlinear function or through some function of the spin configuration that you're trying to look at. So that's what probabilistic autoregressive models do in machine learning, and that's how people model language in machine learning. What people use when you use, for instance, Google Translate, you plug a sentence, and then this you sample the probability distribution, you get a translation back. Okay, and what we've exploited and we've been exploring is that this idea can be extended to quantum states, okay? And so there are some aspects that are important and related to the tractability advantages that these models bring. For instance, it is possible to compute a probability of some configuration sigma or the amplitude of the wave function efficiently for any given sigma, okay? So it means that those wave functions are so-called tractable in that you can compute their amplitudes and so on. They can be sampled efficiently in linear time in the number of configurations versus, for instance, when you're using like Markov chain Monte Carlo, which usually you cannot guarantee that you're sampling the probability distribution or the wave function exactly. They can be easily defined in any spatial dimensions, especially important in 2 and 3D, without tractability issues, for instance, compared to PEPs, where contracting them in 2D, it's very difficult, and even in 3D is even harder. Their expressive power can be systematically improved. They're easy to encode, for instance, product states or mean field theories like Gutwiller mean field theory. We can impose symmetries and conservation laws, and there's some advantages remain true also for when you use these models as a wave function. Okay, So let me give you one particular example, the one that we've been exploring the most, which is a recurrent neural network. Okay, and they're graphically represented in this form, but they're basically just a nonlinear function and a recurrent, that we call recurrently. So we define some vector hn, which is a real vector with d entries. And what we do is we have some matrix W that multiplies H times some spin configuration sigma, and we add some vector V and then apply a nonlinearity. And that gives you your new updated vector H. And we call this recurrent, okay, recurrently. And so because of this structure, then this allows us to compute or to parameterize this conditional distribution, because when we apply this, for instance, this so-called softmax function, we can indeed parameterize this this conditional distribution. Okay, so it's because this vector here, or through this function here, is a normalized probability distribution. So we're able to basically parameterize every conditional through this recurrent relation. That's the important thing. So here, the expressive power of the model is expressed through the dimensionality of this vector H, and its dimensionality is D, and it is basically the expressive power of the model, and it's analogous to the bond dimension in a matrix product state. Okay, and as you see, if we call this function recurrently on and on, so we're able to produce this conditional distributions and consequently the full joint distribution. They can represent any probability distributions as they're a universal function approximator for probability distributions. The other thing that's important, you can sample this probability distribution exactly, efficiently in a number of computations, which is proportional to the number of degrees of freedom n. So the with d linearly in d. Yeah, so it's basically we need to parameterize this probability distribution, so we make those a function of some vector h that we multiply by some matrix u, and then we basically take the exponential of every component and then we normalize it by the sum. So then we get a valid probability distribution. It just because these vectors are real, and so this gives you a positive number. Mm-hmm. Oh. It's just that. But you could, in principle, choose something else. Mm-hmm. Okay, so, but let me just highlight two key important aspects about this. So they can be sampled efficiently, even if the distribution that it encodes is glassy or difficult to sample by other means, okay? So even if the distribution is rough, you can get exact samples out of the distribution, which is useful for problems where the sampling is tractably, where the sampling is very difficult. So you can in principle express any probability distribution, but then the dimensionality of the vector may grow exponentially if you want to express any complicated function. Exactly. And that doesn't even account for the fact that you have to fix and fine-tune the parameters such that you're representing a probability distribution that encodes, for instance, an NP-hard problem. So there's two limitations, or two roadblocks, so there's no violation of complexity. So as I was saying before, you can define wave functions too. So I basically express how to represent probability distributions very quickly, but you can also express wave functions through this construction. So the simplest way to express a wave function is by basically constructing a coherent superposition of the square root of the probability amplitude, and that it's one possibility. It gives you only wave functions that are positive in the computational basis sigma, okay? But of course, we want to express more complex wave functions, so we can add a phase that we can extract out of this recurrent relation sigma. Out of this recurrent relation h that I have here. We basically, out of that vector h, we can compute a new phase and then attach the phase to the wave function, and that just allows you to try to approximate ground states and real-time dynamics. You can do many, many things. And so this was introduced in this paper by my student and my collaborators here. The other thing that is interesting is we can define this wave functions in two dimensions. And this is perhaps the most attractive characteristic of these ansatz. So we can replace instead, for a single hint state, we can pass one hint vector, but we can pass it around in two dimensions, okay? And so what we do is basically we take two directions and then we start passing these vectors around in 2D so that the ansatz has the structure induced by, I don't know, the dimensionality of your problem or the dimensionality of your Hamiltonian and so on. And what's interesting is this wave function remains tractable in 2D and in 3D, as opposed to, for instance, PEPs, where like they become very difficult to contract in 2D and so on. So this wave function, again, can be computed, at least the amplitude of any configuration can be computed exactly in polynomial time, even in 2D or in 3D. Okay, and that brings advantages. There's also the so-called dilated recurrent neural networks. If we wanted to account for slowly decaying correlations, so we can use this multi-layer recurrent neural networks where different layers are. So this is the first layer, this is the second layer, and the third one. And so the idea is that different layers capture correlations at different scales. So this is similar in spirit to the Mera ansatz in tensor network. Okay, so we can define them, and we've used them, and it's very useful. So, okay, so that's kind of like the technical part, but let me tell you two applications, or two examples of applications. One is a data-driven reconstruction of quantum states, or quantum state tomography. And so let me tell you what that is. So quantum state tomography is the process of reconstructing a quantum state through measurements on the system. And it's supposed to be the gold standard for verification and benchmarking of quantum devices, which are useful for characterizing signals, diagnosing errors, and detecting errors in quantum states produced by quantum computers, for instance, for entanglement verification and so on. And the idea is that we need to go beyond standard quantum state tomography, which is limited by the exponential complexity of the representation of the quantum state. And why? Because there's a lot of progress in controlling quantum devices, availability of measurements performed with good accuracy. And so the bottleneck in estimating progress in the an estimation of quantum states is this curse of dimensionality, this exponential growth. So can we alleviate it, right? And so here are some examples of papers where like you experiments going well beyond what we can reconstruct with quantum state tomography. So quantum phases of matter with Rydberg simulator, 256 atoms, problem topological spin liquids. This is one of my papers with 1,800 qubits, so it's out of D-Wave, quantum chemistry, and more. So there's a lot of progress and a lot of fast growth in these devices, but there's not a lot of progress in how we can benchmark them and so on, at least quantum state tomography wise techniques. So how to make quantum state tomography efficient? So people introduce parametrization. So you have to exploit knowledge about the system, because otherwise this won't scale. And so we introduce systems or representation of the quantum state with good scaling. So for instance, structural information that we know about the quantum state, for instance, that the state is pure and you can represent it with a matrix product state. Or if the state is not pure, you can use matrix product operators. And so this has been studied, but like in quantum state tomography in 1D and there's two papers. So it works very well, but it's best suited for systems in 1D. We introduced this idea of quantum state tomography using restricted Boltzmann machines, and it works for pure states and mixed states. So this is the pure state paper by Giacomo Torlai, who was used to be at Perimeter. And then for mixed states, there's the paper again by Giacomo Torlai and Roger Melko here. They introduced this beautiful idea of latent space purification. So basically a density matrix defined in terms of a neural network. So this works really well for pure states. We get high fidelity reconstructions and good scaling, but restricted to pure states. But then mixed states with high fidelity, unfortunately, this approach had poor scaling. So it was very computationally demanding. So what we did was to propose a way to reconstruct quantum states where we parameterize the measurement statistics, not the state, the quantum state directly. Okay, and then using this idea, we learn quantum states from synthetic measurement mimicking experimental data. Okay, and this turned out to work really well for mixed states with some structure, of course, because these are big systems, and reasonable scaling. Okay, so let me show you this learning quantum state. So what we do is we prepare an unknown quantum state, we apply measurements, and this measurement should probe enough information about the quantum state so that we can reconstruct it. We repeat and collect the statistics of the measurement because every time we measure the state, we destroy it. And so we have to repeat this process on and on. And then at the end, we collected this big data set of measurement outcomes. And so what do we do with it? We just infer a reconstruction of the state that is consistent with those measurement outcomes. Okay? And so we get some raw start. And hopefully at the end, we certify the reconstruction with respect to some quantum state we were trying to produce in the experiment or in the lab. Okay, so that's the idea. So the measurements that we use, they're called, they're described by operators, positive operator value measures, and this POVMs are defined by some operators M that describe the experiment. They're a collection of operators MA, where you have M of them. They're positive semi-definite, and they sum up to the identity. So M describes the experimental apparatus that you use, and then Born rule connects quantum theory and your experiment with what you see in the experiment, right? The probability of observing some outcome A is given by a trace of rho times the measurement operator MA, or the POVM element MA. This is very general, but the measurement operators that we use are called informationally complete measurements. And what that means is that you can imagine that your state is a 3D object. And so for you to be able to reconstruct it, you have to observe it from many different viewpoints so that you collect information about it so you can reconstruct it. So that's important. So we use informationally complete measurements. And the other thing that's important is that if you have an informationally complete measurement, the relation between rho and p can be inverted. So in Born rule, we go from rho to p. If the measurement is informationally complete, you can go from rho, so from p to rho. Okay. That's key about the measurements that we apply. And so here is the inverse relation. So you define rho in terms of the probability distribution of measurement outcomes, and you have the measurement operators, and you have this overlap matrix T inverse, and this T is dependent on the measurement that you apply on the system. You can think of this expression as a factorization of the state in terms of a probability distribution and a set of single qubit tensors if the measurements that you applied were single qubit. What that means is all the entanglement and potential complexity of the state come from this distribution P, okay? And then out of this expression, you can do tomography, you can do real-time dynamics in terms of this probability distribution, you can explore measurements, you can do a lot of things, and we've explored all those things. So in terms of tensor networks, so this is the expression for Born rule. So you take your state, you multiply by the measurement, and then take trace, which are these lines here. And this gives you P. The inverse is this expression here. So your density matrix is equal to P multiplied by some single tensor operators. And so that's why all the complexity of the state ends up in the correlations induced by P. Okay. As long as, they don't exist. They don't have to exist. So you can have, for instance, over complete measurements and this T doesn't exist, but usually the pseudo inverse exists. So we've used, for instance, measurements for which T inverse exists, but we've also used measurements for which it doesn't, and then you have to use the pseudo inverse to get a representation of the quantum state. But at that point, this representation is non-unique, and so you have to be careful about it. So the inside was, instead of parameterizing rho, we will parameterize p, okay, with one of these probabilistic models. And we'll use one of those autoregressive models, such as like the recurrent neural networks or the so-called transformer architectures. And because of the advantages that I already mentioned, they allow for exact sampling, tractable density. And then what we use is we take this data set that we collected from the experiment or the simulation of the experiment, and we use a statistical principle called maximum likelihood estimation, which is basically telling your model to assign high probability to the samples that you saw in the experiment, which makes sense because if you see it in the experiment, it means it has high probability of occurring. And then here, let me show you some results for some quantum states. So we consider mostly synthetic data and one real experiment, but let me tell you first about the synthetic data sets. We consider the GHZ state, which is this cat state, all 0, 0, 0, 0, 0 plus 1, 1, 1, 1, okay? And that's this state here. But then we also consider noisy versions of that state. For instance, GHZ with local depolarization, which is a model of the coherent of a qubit, where with probability 1 minus p, the qubit remains intact, and probability p, you add an error. And this is state here. And it can be written as a matrix product operator. So you can try to simulate measurement for very, very large systems because of the simplicity of the state that you're trying to simulate. So here is the process, the learning process is learning a 2-qubit with local depolarization. And so it's very simple, it's only 2 qubits, but what we see is that when we use this maximum likelihood estimation principle, we minimize the distance between the probability distribution of the true GHZ set and the P model, the probability distribution that we use to model the state, and this distance goes to zero as we tune the model. And this is the fidelity of the classical fidelity, which is basically the overlap between the distributions. And as we train or as we optimize the model, this fidelity goes to one. And here is the quantum fidelity between the two states. And again, as we make the model better and better, you get to fidelity basically one. So these are for 2 qubits, and we use a restricted Boltzmann machine, one of these architectures that people study in machine learning, but we found it very difficult to scale for a larger system. So we went ahead and used this recurrent neural network that I was mentioning before, and then we were able to get to up to 80 qubits with high fidelity, okay? Yes. That's right, so it means that when you have high noise in this local depolarization, this distribution is basically flat. And so there's nothing to learn. And so it's very easy to get to that distribution. And as you reduce the noise, this distribution become very peaked and they're harder to learn. They have more structure and there's more information. Sorry, I didn't mention that, but that's an excellent question. So we were able to get to up to 80 qubits with noise and without noise. And what we found is that is remarkable is that learning this GHZ state requires only a linear samples of the order of linear in the size of the system, okay, on the number of qubits. So it worked really well. So these are the experiments where we see that we need a sample complexity NS that is linear in the size of the system at a fixed fidelity of 0.95, if I remember correctly. So that's it. Let me show you a small experimental demonstration. So these are results from an experiment on an IBM machine. It's only 3 qubits, so we couldn't go to 80. But what's clear is that at least compared to traditional quantum state tomography, our results work really well, and our technique works well. This was published this year. And finally, I think this is learning ground states of local Hamiltonians. So this is transverse field easing Hamiltonian for 50 spins. So again, we reach high fidelity, but then what I'm showing you here is just how we reproduce the correlation functions of, say, the ground state of the transverse field Ising model in 1D, so expectation value of sigma ix, and the red or orange is DMRG data, and our reconstructed state is green. So this is one body correlation. This is a point two body correlation, sigma 1, sigma I along the z direction, and the reconstruction is again very reasonable. So far, all the states that I've shown you are very simple. So we wanted to test on a more complicated state. So here we tried on the ground state of the Heisenberg model on the triangular lattice, so that it doesn't have a simple sign structure, but a more complicated sign structure, because we're using probability distributions to represent the state. So I think it was the referee who wondered, can you really represent ground state with a complicated sign structure with just this probability distribution? But this is a demonstration that, so this is a synthetic two-body correlation function obtained from DMRG, and this is from the reconstructed state in the recurrent neural network. So we were quite happy. So we didn't explore that, but that's a good question. So what we did was we had a very expressive recurrent neural network that worked out of the box. So we didn't explore how hard we had to push on this effective bond dimension that we had. So we just know that it works, but it's just because it has a large dimension. How much time do I have? Okay, so let me quickly tell you about, okay, so last comment about this is, so this data sets that we collected in our paper were eventually understood theoretically, and they were called classical shadows, okay? So these data sets already contain a lot of information about the quantum state and correlation functions. And this is from this paper by Robert Huang and John Preskill, where they took exactly the same data that we produce or the same models, and they show that even just the data set contains a lot of information. You can get all these quantities very accurately already without training the model, okay? So that was kind of like an interesting paper that came. Okay, so we've explored all sorts of extensions of these ideas. We've used this probabilistic representation to simulate real-time dynamics, quantum circuits. We've used this to study open system dynamics in this paper. And so you can use this probability distributions, and you can write, for instance, Schrodinger equation in terms of the probability distribution, and then you can try it and using these models to solve real-time or approximate real-time dynamics of this quantum many-body system. So in the last 5 minutes, I'm going to tell you about variational neural annealing, which is a technique that we introduced, or my student Mohammed and our collaborators introduced, to study combinatorial optimization. Okay, and so it's basically a classical technique where we have some Ising target Hamiltonian, such as this, the idea is to find the spin configuration sigma that minimizes the energy of this target Hamiltonian. Okay, and there's many problems that can be written down in this form, and there's this very beautiful paper by Andrew Lucas, easing formulations of many MP problems, where like all sorts of important problems in engineering and science in general can be written down as just finding the ground state of this Hamiltonian. It's a classical problem. The idea is there's a technique called simulated annealing where you do Markov chain Monte Carlo using that Hamiltonian and you slowly cool down the temperature. And you hope that by using this simulated thermal fluctuations, you eventually find this true ground state of the system. Okay, so you do this Markov chain Monte Carlo, Metropolis Hastings, and you slowly reduce the temperature and you hope to get here. So the question that we asked was, can we simulate these techniques variationally? Okay, and so what we did was we used the variational principle of statistical mechanics, where like you know that the free energy of some probability distribution is greater than the true free energy of the system in thermal equilibrium. And what we did was we proposed using a probability distribution based on recurrent neural networks, and then asked the question, is it better than traditional simulated annealing? Okay, so that was the idea, and so we solved this a minimization problem using our recurrent neural networks, and then slowly decrease the temperature, and then hope for the best if you want. We also tried this in a quantum setting inspired by quantum annealing, where we promote these recurrent neural networks to a quantum state, and then the classical Hamiltonian to a quantum Hamiltonian, or free energy to ground state energy. And then we try to optimize, again, the classical part of the Hamiltonian. This I mentioned already. So let me show you quickly the results that we found. So this is for the Edwards Anderson model. So it's this target Hamiltonian in a two-dimensional square where Jij encode the problem and they're randomly selected from this the uniform distribution in between minus one and one. So I guess since I don't have time, so I'm gonna focus on this figure B, okay, where we show the residual energy of the solutions that we find versus the number of annealing steps or the time we spend annealing in the different simulation techniques. So here in red is simulated annealing. Here in purple is simulated quantum annealing. They're all Markov chain Monte Carlo based techniques. And here in blue is our variational classical annealing technique. And what we find is that if you have a short time or a small computational budget, it's always better to do simulated annealing or simulated quantum annealing. But if you have enough time, it's better to try and go and perform this variational classical annealing, where we find that sometimes, or in many, many cases, our algorithm is orders of magnitude more accurate than the traditional techniques. And so we thought it was really, really interesting, but we wanted to try harder models, so we went and tried spin glasses, fully connected spin glasses. They're very difficult to solve in practice, and so we targeted the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model, which is this Hamiltonian here, where Jij is a symmetric matrix from a sample from a Gaussian distribution. Okay? So these are much harder problems. We also tried this one. This is very interesting. Wisher-Plantet ensemble, where the idea is that we know what the solution is, but the solution is very difficult to find. So it's similar to finding the needle in the haystack. So the needle is this ferromagnetic state, but this ferromagnetic state is surrounded by a bunch of ferromagnetic states with about the same energy. Okay, and they're exponentially close to each other in energy. So that makes finding this configuration very difficult. And what we find in the end is something similar, that if you have short time, then it's better to use simulated annealing and simulated quantum annealing. But if you have enough computational time, it's always better to use our technique based on recurrent neural networks. Okay, and then, so this is for the Sherrington-Kirkpatrick model. This is for this Wishart-Plantet ensemble where we know what the solution is. And we find again, several orders of magnitude more accurate solutions than simulated annealing. So this finally, the last comment I wanted to make is, so this models can be said that this Wishart Plantin ensemble model can be tuned, and we can make it really, really hard for any algorithm to find the solution. And when we do that, then of course we break everything, right? We break simulated annealing, simulated quantum annealing, and our algorithm is a little bit better, but still, we can break it. And so that's it. Sorry for the delay. So we introduced two examples of applications of recurrent neural networks in quantum state reconstruction and in solving combinatorial optimization problems. I just wanted to mention that this is just a few examples that trying to showcase these opportunities that machine learning techniques, ideas, and research culture can spark in this field. Thank you so much.
Can I ask a question?
Correct, if somebody is asking a question, so maybe.
Okay, so.
No, somebody is already asking a question.
So oh, sorry.
Can you wait for that?
Some of them probably yes. So what I know is that the Max and Minkat can be formulated as an Ising Hamilton. Yeah. No, we have not tried comparing with those algorithms. So I know. So the I guess what's attractive about this is that this is very generic. So many of the fastest algorithms usually exploit more structure than what we do. So I'm not sure which algorithm you're talking about and whether that exploits a lot of the structure of the problem or not, but that's right.
Okay, so next question from online audience.
Yes, I have a question regarding if we impose some symmetry. So, for instance, if the state has some translational symmetry, in this setup, we have directed arrows. So, it seems that translational symmetry is not so manifest. Can you impose some translational symmetry and make it manifest in this case?
So, I'm not sure I understood, but if the question is, can you impose translational symmetry? Then the answer is yes, we've done it. Not in the examples that I've shown today, but we've done it. And you can impose that symmetry and many other symmetries.
And how is it realized?
Yeah, what you do is you do an averaging of the amplitude. So it's done at the sampling level. And what you do is you take a sample and then you translate the sample and then you report all the amplitudes as the average of the wave function, and that gives you translational symmetry. So it's done at the sampling level. Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, so you mean in the classical systems or in the quantum? Mm-hmm. So we have not done that in detail, okay? So we know, but is so I guess it's tricky. So we've tried, right? Like, but what we do not find or what we do not see is that beautiful fact that happens in tensor networks where you, as you make the bond dimension higher and higher, you start capturing longer and longer correlations. So that doesn't happen here. And so we know that the model becomes more and more powerful, but what we don't know is how that changes the physical pictures, right? Like, so we don't know if, so we don't know exactly what grows when you grow the dimensionality of the hidden state. So it's hard to, so the reason we have not reported this is because we don't know exactly what to report, right? Like, we know that everything improves, but it's not that when you increase this bond dimension, then the maximum amount of entanglement grows systematically, right? Like, or that the longer range correlations get better and better. So it doesn't work like that, and that's why we don't quite know how to report it. I think the is no, so it's easy. It's not easier or harder to in 1D or in 2D, but of course we exploit right what we know. So here, when we do 2D systems, we use this right, and so it makes it easier with respect to using a snake. We've tried both, and so when we go for 2D systems, then we get better than if we try 1D systems, right? Like if we try 1D instances. So it's equally simpler. So I guess what's harder is not the dimensionality, but the sign structure in the computational basis. That's what limits most of this computation. So you have to, so it's not about the dimensionality. Dimensionality almost plays no role. Yes, that's right. So these are classical but frustrated systems. So okay, let me show you. For instance, in 1D we see that effect. So this is not frustrated. In 2D we see the effect. This one, which has the strongest frustration, we see this too. We see that effect, and we see it also for quantum systems. So I didn't have time to show you the results on annealing on a quantum ground state, but we also see something similar.
Have you tried VMC?
We've tried on VMC, and it helps. Let me see if I have some. I don't think I have them here, but for instance, one thing we've seen is we've tried targeting the ground state of the triangular Heisenberg model, and through annealing, we are able to beat DMRG, 2D DMRG, if we make the system big enough. One other thing that we've tried is converging on this topological entanglement entropy for some systems where QMC is very difficult to converge, and we are able to converge through annealing and targeting the state. But
that, in that case,
yes, you could. The problem is these are 2D systems, so we can go bigger.
Okay.
So for small systems, yes. Yeah.
Okay.
That's right.
Okay. There's one question.
So we've studied topological ordered phases in 2D. For instance, we know how to represent the ground state of the toric code exactly in terms of recurrent neural networks, and we know that it can describe this Bose-Haber-Spin liquid. That's a ring exchange Hamiltonian in 2D on the Kagome, and we were able to saturate the topological entanglement entropy better than QMC, for instance. Those are the two successful examples we have. They're very simple, but they work. But we've compared against parallel tempering. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So with parallel tempering beats the implementation we have, this variational annealing, but we have a variational implementation of parallel tempering. And this beats parallel tempering. That's right. That's not published yet, but in some instances it beats parallel tempering. Uh-huh. Exactly. So I think the reason why we are able to do this is because these models allow for exact sampling. And when you have exact sampling versus a technique where that uses Markov chains and on a glassy landscape, then this brings some advantage. Thank you. Thank you.